Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming to this session. The following paper, as you know, impertinently and playfully titled Nothing in Christianity Makes Sense Except in the Light of Evolution, will be presented today by myself alone, as Paul has been a bit under the weather this weekend. But if I occasionally use the singular first-person pronoun, forgive me. Paul's been very generous with his time in helping me think through and research this material, and I don't want to downplay his contributions. In this paper, we hope to offer a framework for conversation and reflection about evolution as a possible inspirational pointer to God, and perhaps even a well-fitting counterpart to Christian faith, in contrast to the very oppositional and antagonistic ways that Christianity and evolution are popularly portrayed in the creation-evolution debates. We hope that the arguments presented here could be of use in Christian ministry, possibly teaching and apologetics, especially in academic circles. So in a move that may irritate some and relieve many, we actually won't be attempting any kind of logical articulation as to why Christianity ever could or would make sense. This we leave to the philosophers and other probably smarter scholars. Our primary goals here are to first have better conversations with people who are hostile to religion, especially Christian religion, helping them to see first and foremost that the two need not be considered at odds as depicted in popular media, and stretching this a bit further that Christians do not have to embrace evolutionary views grudgingly. The arguments of this paper may not be enough to change anyone's mind, we think, but they have served us in many difficult conversational settings by opening the door, at least, to productive dialogue in the future. Secondly, we hope to be able to do a little damage to the assumption that the Christian God can't be a good God or that evolution can't be the right theory of creation on account of all the messiness and pain in it. The conversation on creation and evolution has been going on a long time, but we think conversations on theodicy and evolution may be more successful at helping both anti-evolutionists and anti-theists consider what a Christian worldview looks like and offers believers and scientists. So, with that in mind, evolution has always been problematic for Christians. From its first articulation and reception, the theory has seemed at odds with doctrinal Christian views about divine special creation and human exceptionalism. The long gradual process of change required for speciation via natural selection also seems to disrupt Christian views on a primordial fall, where suffering came into the world in a singular event through Adam and Eve, the first humans. For folks who believe in a literal fall, suffering and death are inherited conditions having been brought into the world with even Adam's first act of disobedience, and thus all existing cruelty and death is the result of human sinfulness and the influence of the devil and not divine will. We personally do not find such views compelling. So literal fall folks may not find much of theological value in this talk, and we understand that. And of course, we can have informal conversations about that later. But one of the starting assumptions of this talk is that the presence of pain is problematic for Christians, especially Christians who have been witness to great suffering and know it intimately. And for a lot of these folks, the belief in a literal fall just doesn't help that much. We'll be focusing instead on answering another Christian objection to evolution, the widespread sentiment shared by many that God would not choose such a process. I found the following quote from a creationist blogger particularly explicit on this point. And they write, "What kind of nature would a God who creates through the death that is essential to evolution, would a God have who creates through the death that is essential to evolution? Rather than loving us, such a God would be indifferent and capricious. This kind of God would be nothing more than a bully." Evolution has been called wasteful and cruel. And indeed, why should there be so many dead bodies in the wake of thinking, loving, sentient, evolved beings that have capacity for wisdom and grace from God? To quote a writer I love, Annie Dillard, "Nature is profligate, a spendthrift with limitless capital." In imagining the tenets of evolution, philosopher of biological science Philip Kitcher has said, that there is nothing kindly or providential in any of this, and it seems breathtakingly wasteful and inefficient. Indeed, if we imagine a human observer presiding over a miniaturized version of the whole show, peering down on his creation, it is extremely hard to equip the face with a kindly expression. Atheist science writers have spilled much ink, pointing to the seeming cruelty and meaninglessness of evolution as arguments against a loving Christian God. Science popularizer P.Z. Myers has said that we are not the progeny of gods, we are the children of worms, not the product of divine planning, but of cruel chance and brutal winnowing. Atheist convert Charles Darwin was also disturbed by the large role pain and death necessarily play in his theory. As a blogger on God of Evolution observes, the cannibalistic behavior of the ichneumon wasp larvae was famously mentioned by Charles Darwin in an 1860 letter to Asa Gray as a reason for his growing doubt in the existence of a benevolent God. Quote, "I cannot persuade myself," Darwin wrote, "that a beneficent and omnipotent God would have designedly created the ichneumonidae with the express intention of their feeding within the living bodies of caterpillars, or that a cat should play with mice." If we open our eyes, widespread suffering of animals and human beings appears to be the rule in our world and not the exception. As scholar David B. Morris writes in The Culture of Pain, pain is as elemental as fire or ice. Like love, it belongs to the most basic human experiences that make us who we are. Although well-heeled Westerners, mostly white, like us here, will probably have to look hard and long to truly internalize this. We tend to react strongly to tragic events like terrorist attacks or personal episodes of injury and illness and then sort of get on with our daily lives. Even meat eating is for us a rather cheerful and uncomplicated act. Many of the people on this planet, who may even be our own neighbors, however, are not privileged to entertain even the idea of moving on from suffering. If we as Christians want to be conversational with the rest of creation, including fellow Christians who have seen suffering and do find it problematic, then we need to address the question, why so much of it, and what does it mean for us as people of faith and science? Voluminous academic and popular writings have been published espousing views on theodicy, or the theological exploration of the problem of evil and pain. Yet there has been no consensus from thinkers, as we can imagine, on the meaning and purpose of suffering in a Christian worldview. It's a theme that is at once intractable and pervasive. The presence of suffering bothers us on an intuitive and emotional level. When contemplating tragedy, we may feel hurt and offended by the appearance of divine indifference to the plight of the innocent especially. Rational arguments and theories may be insufficient answers for such intuitive and emotionally powerful concerns and objections to belief in God. So the rest of this paper attempts to provide an argument for why contemplation of suffering in the biological world might point to Christianity and not away from it. We argue that the natural suffering intrinsic to evolutionary theory and the human suffering that characterize the story of Christ are mutually resonant and might even have a more conversational relationship in our thinking about the purpose of suffering if popular views on Christianity and evolution were not so antagonistic. We take it at face value that suffering, death, and waste are hallmarks of evolutionary theory. Does this fact necessarily make the theory problematic for Christians? Can the uglier aspects of evolution be not just reconciled, but indeed complementary to Christian depictions of a loving and pacific God? As depicted repeatedly in Jesus' ministry, God does not seem to prefer suffering as a state of being. Jesus' response to suffering was to alleviate others' pain, especially among the poor and powerless. This observation might perhaps point us back to the view that God would not choose evolution as God's creative process. However, Christians seem to have a problem if they state categorically that God is averse to pain or that God actively undertakes to diminish pain in the world. Sacrificial suffering is a central facet of the Christian faith. By far, the most recognizable symbol of Christianity is the cross. Yet the hard question, why does God require Jesus' brutal torture and humiliation, is too often asked with tenuous resolve in church settings and ultimately answered with upturned empty palms. Many of my darkest hours as a Christian have been spent contemplating the following question with no hope of an adequate response. Should we believe in a God who seems to condone, tolerate, or require the suffering of innocent creatures? I want to outline now three possible responses and see which ones feel the most adequate. Option number one is no, we should not believe in such a God. This might be called the total disavowal of all religion response. It claims that we can respond to the problem of suffering in the Christian narrative by turning from Christianity towards an atheistic worldview, as so many have. Embracing evolutionary theory as the only explanatory framework for why things are the way they are. Yet part of what we turn toward here is the suffering and waste that is such a prevalent theme and indeed inescapable in evolution by natural selection. The idea of competition factors heavily in almost every study of evolutionary biology, and this word gestures mightily towards the fact that in nature, losing out in the big competition is a gruesome prospect filled with almost unthinkable pain of starvation or predation or both. It appears that in even the most removed or, quote, scientific mindset, that even the most removed or scientific mindset can't keep us completely from confronting the reality of pain around us. Atheists overwhelmingly accept that death and competition lead to beautiful diversity, and that suffering is simply a necessary aspect of this process. I find a lot of the comments from atheistic scientists about the idea of competition and differential survival rather cold, calculated, and uncompassionate views of creation. They view suffering as mechanistic, often a series of neutral causes and effects allowing some creatures to thrive and others to struggle. More importantly and problematically, the atheistic total disavowal of metaphysical meaning offers us little reason to respond to the suffering of others with anything but sneering condescension regarding their lack of adaptive graces. A lot of brilliant ethicists and evolutionarily inclined thinkers have offered their views on why humans are prone to acts of compassion, caring, cooperation, and empathy. But these don't ring that true or inspiring in my ears. And I don't see a lot of these people spending time offering hope and succor to communities who suffer. Our second response to the question, possible response to the question, should we believe in such a God, would be maybe, or no, are there better options? And this could maybe be called the agnostic go fish response. I know a lot of folks who respond to these issues by turning from Christianity, but not towards total atheism, toward more what they feel to be nonviolent belief systems, such as yogic or Buddhist spiritual traditions. These forms of mystic spirituality are increasingly seen as okay to espouse in academic or progressive circles, so that might be another reason why they're so attractive to people when contemplating these questions. And in any case, they don't seem to publicly capsize the belief holders' claim to rational thinking and intelligence. Great. I think these systems of belief can be very helpful and instructive to us about the nature of God. There are a lot of people who know God, but not by the Christian names that we use. And many of these traditions consider evil and good as co-constitutive, irreducible in the fabric of the cosmos and the character of the divine. But when we focus our attention on seeing harmony everywhere, I think we actually might be doing a disservice to those who experience suffering individually. What kind of action is, in fact, expected of us to reduce suffering and recognize it as actually bad if it's just part of the fabric of the cosmos and it should be expected? I actually don't know, but personally I find the most synergy and comfort in the third option, which I would like to label the nervous disciple response. In this worldview, we can respond to the problem of suffering by turning towards its theological tensions, embracing it as necessary and inevitable for reasons that might remain unclear forever, but as Jesus did, working always to diminish it on an individual basis, and answering those who ask us honestly, we do not know why creation suffers so and why it has to be this way. However, we do know that our God suffers with us. This is unlike the options outlined above. And as Christians, I think we are called to turn towards suffering with acts of solidarity, kindness, and love, as in Jesus's example. We are not required to find a godly intention or reason for the existence of pain and suffering. And in fact, I think it's well within a Christian's right to claim that there is nothing God-given whatsoever in its existence. And yet there it is, and here we are. A professor of systematic theology that I've worked with on a very limited basis, Reinhold Bernhardt, over at Basel, has written that when theologians refer sufferers of tragedy to the biblical educating, disciplining, testing, and punishing acts of God, they often are attempting to interpret the tragic in the light of the omnipotence and omniscience of God. This implies a far too anthropomorphic understanding of God and God's activity, where God acts like a pedagogue of former times, like a judge, or like a strict father. The tragic becomes elevated into the divine will. God is declared as the author of evil and suffering. However, Bernhardt continues, I find enough evidence in the New Testament for claiming that God's very being is unconditional and universal grace. God's providential activity is not the cause of the tragic, but comes in as the power which heals the wounds of those who were afflicted with tragic experiences. Neither the misery of the observable world nor the heartbrokenness of the biblical story appear to be arbitrary or avoidable. Rather, grace through suffering is just a painful fact of the world we live in and the theology we espouse. We personally find great comfort in a God that does not or cannot or will not prevent suffering, yet chooses to suffer with us. A God which perceives the heavy burdens of creation and responds with loving kindness and, where possible, actual help. Seen this way, the Christian God is neither outside creation nor cosmically unsympathetic, nor happy to use suffering for punitive purposes. No other religious tradition, we think, provides us with a deity that gets involved to this extent, humbly and, in fact, to the point of total bodily humiliation, in what looks like camaraderie with the agony of even the humblest being. The idea of resurrection also resonates here, where new possibilities can emerge from what might otherwise seem a place of total desolation. The evolutionary vision that endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful could come from the wreckage of Darwinian differential survival mirrors the Christian view of grace and life in Jesus's resurrection. To quote Bethany Sollerator's lecture at last year's ASA meeting, every instance of suffering, I can't do the accent, unfortunately.
It's a Canadian accent, you should.
Every instance of suffering, death, death and extinction, will find a new meaning, a meaning that the creature itself will share in, a future reality where the promise of a creation made in love will be fulfilled in union with God. And here's Bernhardt again. Out of the randomness and meaninglessness of tragedy, there can grow new meaning, like a new plant can grow of a decomposing grain. Far from being opposed to evolution, in our functional theology, Christianity can be seen as somewhat uniquely and intuitively equipped to respond to some of its most troubling features. We've asserted that on the theme of theodicy, the Christian and evolutionary accounts share similar questions and tensions. We take this continuity to be a sign of mutuality. We cannot easily resolve the problem of evil and suffering in the Bible or in creaturely experience, but if the violence of the Christian narrative turns us in any way away from faith, perhaps the cruciform shape of reality that we find in any naturalistic articulation may lead us back toward, and not further from, a life in Christ and the responsibility to care for those who suffer.
Questions for our speaker?
So I have two questions. They're not very well formed, so
Oh, where?
Which was the question, the premise of innocent. Because the way you phrased it, it sounded as if the assumption was we know and we define what innocence is. So I guess my first question is kind of to ask if you can comment on that. And then my second question is kind of, which is not related, but in reflecting on what you were just saying, I was also thinking about, it seems almost as if suffering is viewed and described here as if we're looking to see what's the cause of suffering and why suffering came about. But I wonder if there are also questions about the purpose of suffering. And I'm thinking specifically about, you know, the verse in the Bible that talks about, you know, Jesus suffered to learn obedience and, you know, God's redemptive purposes for everything and his ability to take even our suffering and turn it into something good. So is that kind of a different narrative to just
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I do think that that's the point at which the 20 minutes here and the
question of
are we purporting to be able to define what innocence is when we say that innocence suffers? Is that fair? And the second is not the cause of suffering, but the purpose of suffering. How can suffering maybe be productive or a part of the plan? I do think that needs to be fleshed out more. I mean, it almost seems like an afterthought in this paper, and that's a weakness and something that I just haven't quite had time to think through yet. You know, I do want to emphasize that this is something of a rhetorical progression that I've started to piece together over years and years of conversations with atheists, where it seems like one of the most surprising things that you could say to them is, you know, evolution and Christianity are mutual descriptions of creation, and that the dark aspects seem to, like, if you overlaid the projector images or something, like, they seem to correspond somehow in a way that really vibrates for me and makes me want to understand more about it and leads me to, you know, and I've said to some of them, if it weren't for evolution, I wouldn't be a Christian anymore. Because all of the above. In terms of defining innocence, I don't know. I think the thing that really bothers me about the literal fall is the idea that, you know, we're all marked and inherited, no matter what we do, animals, children who with horrible diseases. I mean, this really catches in the craw of a lot of people, especially, I think, mothers and fathers with children who, you know, who do suffer birth defects and who do have a great deal of turmoil in their lives. And so I don't know at what point a child becomes not innocent anymore. I mean, maybe the first intentional act of cruelty they perform, which might be way earlier than I expect. I have no idea. But that's a good question. I would be interested in your response.
Good. Other questions?
Thanks, Emily, for a thoughtful presentation. Is sentience required for suffering? I'm just wondering, like, do spiders suffer? Even if you have one of those long, like, a little favorite thing as a kid, pull a leg off a dangling spider.
No, I never did that.
I did. But I'm just wondering, are they suffering? Like, I'm just wondering if consciousness or human consciousness or sentience, at least, or what level of awareness and consciousness is required for the word suffering to actually be relevant and to really apply it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, and somebody who studies biology and neuroscience would probably be better equipped to answer that, I think, on the level that you're asking it. I like to read an essay with my students called Consider the Lobster. It's by David Foster Wallace, and he's not a philosopher, and he's not a scientist. He's just a well-known author. But in this essay, Consider the Lobster, which was written for Gourmet magazine maybe 20 years ago about the Maine Lobster Festival, he does not talk about eating lobster much in a way that you would expect. What he does do is he gives a brief description of the festival, and then he takes you on a tour through the biology of lobsters and crafts this this really amazing progression from viewing the lobster as this sort of bug-like creature, you know, like the spider that we sort of assume doesn't suffer because they don't have the higher cognitive processing, and really teases out so many different lines of questioning that, because one of the major facets of the Maine Lobster Festival, evidently, is people from PETA protesting it, you know, by dressing up as lobsters and painting themselves red and insisting that, you know, when you do throw the lobster live into the pot, you are morally culpable for the suffering of the lobster. So when David Foster Wallace writes this essay, you know, he takes us on this train ride through a lot of the different possible ways to answer that question. And I know that's not my answer, but it's an essay that I've used to spark some discussion in my classes before, which are classes on writing primarily and communication. But the students always realize that it's way more complicated to answer something like that than we would ever hope for it to be. I'd like to be able to say for sure that a pig suffers more than a chicken, and that a cockroach suffers not at all. But
we had a question back there, and then we need to move on to the next session.
That's such a cosmic question. I mean, I like when we do talk about new creation, when we talk about heaven, I mean, I always go somewhere material in my imagination that's away from this planet. But when I read C.S. Lewis a lot, and I love this moment in The Last Battle where there are, you know, Aslan the lion that is the God character in these books, he's standing in front of these two doors. And the real test at the, you know, start of the final creation, the new form of Narnia, where, you know, everything is abundant and somehow there's, you know, a way that things operate, that the rules have just clearly changed. The real test of faith is whether you look on Aslan with fear and hatred, in which case you go through one door, or whether you look on Aslan with fear and love and you go through the other. And yes, it is, you know, all the most beautiful imagery that we've ever imagined about what that means. I hope for that. I like the world we live in. I think it's gorgeous and wonderful, and I love being here. I just wish it weren't so hard to have gotten it this way.
All right, let's thank our speakers.